Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Patron Saint of Second Chances, a novel by Christine Simon. Read by Tim Francis.
Chapter 1. Who will pray for the pipes? Signor Giovannino Speranza, self-appointed mayor of the diminishing village of Prometto, population 212, knew from his 62 years of experience in this world that in dealing with plumbers, one must never show even a hint of weakness. A plumber was the circling vulture of home repair, smug in his knowledge that pipes were the very circulatory system of polite society, and that his poor dope of a client, whoever they might be, was undoubtedly in over their head, and therefore as putty in his unscrupulous hands. These scoundrels were also organized. They had got together, perhaps on a plumber's getaway weekend, and decided that their services ought to cost a minimum of 115 euros an hour. If one still thought in lira, as Signor Speranza did, that came to 222,670, a number which, if one could even fathom it, was patently criminal. This knowledge of the depravity of plumbers, and all their known associates, was why, on this particular July morning, Signor Speranza was taking great care to maintain the upper hand. He was standing in the bathtub, eating his breakfast, which, of course, was a power move, while a junior plumbing inspector from the Regional Water Commission prepared to cut a meticulous hole in the plaster under the bathroom sink.
"Are you sure you would not be more comfortable at the table, signore?"
the young man had asked timidly, upon regarding the circumstances under which he would be expected to work.
"I always eat breakfast in the bath,"
Signor Speranza lied, not breaking eye contact and producing a salt cellar from behind the bottle of Ultra Dolce di Gagne. "Go ahead," he thought, twitching his black moustache from side to side. "Tell me that I don't." The young man coughed and dropped his gaze, and Signor Speranza gave a small snort of triumph. The Speranza's Hotel, a 10-room establishment with a coin-operated jacuzzi and a rooftop terrace, where they lived, and which they had inherited from Signor Speranza's wife's parents, was not the first place in the village the inspector had visited. Indeed, it was the last. He had already made the rounds, he and his little clipboard, to a random sampling of homes and businesses throughout the rocks and cliffs of Prometto. His visit had been a long time coming. In fact, Signor Speranza had been putting it off for 2 years now, through a coordinated system of avoidance. Whenever the Water Commission's number had shown up on the caller ID at Speranza and Sons, the vacuum cleaner maintenance and repair business Signor Speranza had inherited from his father, and whose premises doubled as his mayoral office, he would shout for his assistant, Smilzo. Smilzo would then race to plug in the Hoover Wind Tunnel 2 floor model and hold the nozzle up to the receiver.
"Sorry, I can't hear you," Signor Speranza would shout. "Bad connection."
This method of postponement had worked like a charm until some diligent civil servant had finally followed up in writing. The date had been set. The inspector was to come and examine the pipes. Any pipes discovered to be in disrepair were to be fixed at the expense of the municipality. For small municipalities that could not afford the cost of repairs and who did not qualify for a payment plan, the water would be cut off, and the commission would assist with the resettlement of displaced individuals. Signor Speranza had lingered over this last line, and in particular those two words, displaced individuals, with a queasy feeling in his stomach. Then he had laid the letter aside, and in its place opened the large volume he kept on his desk for just such emergencies, titled The Complete Compendium of Catholic Saints and Blessed or Beatified Persons. He had opened to the P's, running his finger down the appropriate column, and found what he was looking for. St. Vincent Ferrer, Patron Saint of Plumbing. He'd closed the book with a satisfied snap and begun immediately. "Ciao, Vincenzo," he had prayed, clasping his hands. With the exception of the rosary, he liked to keep things casual. "It's Signor Speranza. I am sorry to bother you, but could you take a look at Prometto's pipes?
I know it's a pain in the ass, but there is no money here.
Now, from his perch in the bath, Signor Speranza glared at the junior inspector. Just look at him, he thought, shoveling the last of the scrambled eggs into his mouth. The young man was crouched alongside the washbasin, carefully affixing a square of blue painter's tape to the area he meant to cut open. When he had finished, he leant back to examine his handiwork, and finding it infinitesimally crooked, patiently peeled it off and began again.
"Why don't you just smash it?" Signor Speranza asked when he couldn't stand it any longer.
The junior inspector was aghast.
"Oh, no, signore. You must never smash plaster. That makes it very difficult to repair."
Signor Speranza rolled his eyes to the ceiling. The entire village was facing the wrecking ball, dependent on the report of this giant toddler with his clip-on tie and his sensible four-cylinder car. But yes, by all means, let us be careful with the plaster. Signor Speranza balanced his clean plate on the edge of the bath and fidgeted. He had not been in this particular bathroom for some time, as there had been no guests on this floor of the hotel for at least 2 years. He had chosen this spot for the junior inspector to work, because it was out of the way. But as he looked around, he frowned. A memory stirred.
A leak? Had there been a leak?
And if there had been, how had they fixed it? He studied the checked linoleum, which was unique to the third floor, and got a sudden flash of it, swollen around the base of the sink, an enormous water-filled bubble. His hands went clammy.
"You know," he said, clearing his throat, "I wonder if you might prefer to see the pipes in the kitchen. It's cooler there."
The junior inspector looked up, surprised.
"I have already taped, signore."
"Yes," sighed Signor Speranza, "I've seen you do that."
They both gazed bleakly at the blue-taped square.
"Well,"
said the junior inspector into the awkward silence. He bent over his bag, and at that precise moment Signor Speranza glimpsed gleaming round his adversary's neck a silver medallion imprinted with none other than the pallid image of St. Vincent Ferrer himself.
"Signore," whispered Signor Speranza, his voice trembling with emotion, "you're a friend of St. Vincent."
The junior inspector glanced down at his medal and smiled. Feeling that it was now safe to let his guard down, Signor Speranza dropped to a sitting position, propping his elbows on the rim of the bath.
"I am very impressed," he enthused. "You do not often find this kind of devoutness now in young people."
The junior inspector nodded and pulled on a pair of goggles.
"It's very important, signore. My father says people do not take care of things the way they used to. Someone has to pray for the pipes."
Then he switched on the saw and began to cut into the plaster. The junior inspector's words, along with the buzzing of the saw, seemed to bounce and ricochet off the porcelain sides of the bathtub and ring in Signor Speranza's ears.
"Someone has to pray for the pipes."
He was reminded of a similar argument he had made to the village priest, Don Rocco, regarding vacuum cleaners.
"How has the Vatican not considered the need for their protection, Father?"
he had asked fretfully, after yet another customer had failed to show up for their yearly service appointment, and a search of the otherwise complete compendium had yielded nothing. Signor Speranza gasped and put his hand to his mouth. He understood everything now. This upstart clerk was not praying that the nation's pipes might outlast their prescribed usefulness, as he himself had been doing. No, this dastardly pup had been praying instead for their deliverance. At this instant of terrible reckoning, two things happened. The junior inspector, switching off the saw and pushing back his goggles, gently eased the freshly cut block of plaster from its place in the wall, sending a chalky shower of white dust onto the linoleum, and Signor Speranza, his black moustache trembling, recalled the means by which he had repaired the washbasin. It came to him as a kind of vision. Smilzo, in shirt sleeves, perched on the edge of the bath, chewing pack after pack of pink bubblegum. It was the junior inspector's turn to gasp as he shone his flashlight into the hole.
"Signore," he cried, "what is this?"
Resuming his earlier sang-froid, which at this point was the only thing he had left, Signor Speranza glanced into the hole, crossed his arms and sniffed.
I think it's Hubbubub.
Chapter 2.
Do you want me to show you a real problem?
Signor Speranza was subdued after that. He stood there, in the bathtub, as the junior inspector filled out a form in triplicates and handed it to him.
Here is the estimate, signore. The town will need to remit payment within 60 days, or the commission will cut off the water.
Signor Speranza stared at the form. The junior inspector had written the total in blue ballpoint and circled it. 70,000 euros. The numbers swam on the page. 70,000, it might as well have been 1,000,000.
Signore, the junior inspector called to him from somewhere very far away, would you like to see if you qualify for a payment plan?
Signor Speranza must have nodded, because the junior inspector turned to a fresh sheet on his clipboard and rattled off a string of questions. Was Prometto home to any major form of industry? Did it have a shopping mall? Any unique or culturally significant tourist attractions? Was there perhaps potential for mining in the area, such as natural gas or coal deposits?
No, no, no. Signor Speranza shook his head. Prometto didn't have any of those things. It was just a nowhere place, a going nowhere place.
Had the junior inspector ever seen it on a map? It was like a tiny speck at the bottom, just at the point where Italy's narrow boot might meet the pavement if it were grinding out a cigarette. The junior inspector didn't answer, but just checked his boxes, and when he was finished, he sighed and returned his pen to his pocket.
I am very sorry, signore, but it appears your village does not have the resources necessary to qualify for a payment plan at this time.
Signor Speranza looked at him dazed.
No money, the young man said loudly, as if Signor Speranza were deaf. There is no money here, signore. There is not even the chance of money.
The Lord works in mysterious ways. Signor Speranza would not be able to see it until much later, when everything was over, but the pointless, maddening time he spent at work that afternoon was destined to change the course of his entire life. 3 hours after the departure of the junior inspector, he sat at the back of the once flourishing Speranza and Sons on the Via Sant'Agata, just him and his terrible secret that they were all doomed. He had avoided his wife Betta on his way out of the door, and she had called after him not to forget the balloons for his uncle's birthday party, and just hearing the words had brought tears to his eyes. A party? What was there to celebrate? He had the town's ledger open on one side of his desk, and the compendium on the other. He was no longer on speaking terms with St. Vincent Ferrer. He had, in fact, taken a permanent marker, and in full sight of God, run a line through his name. He should have known better than to trust the patron saint of plumbers. The ledger had yielded no hope. As he had known already, there was no money in the coffers. He glanced around his shop at the quiet ranks of vacuum cleaners and the dim coils of replacement tubing, and sighed. There was no money here, either. He had discussed the matter only a week ago with Don Rocco.
"Understand me, Father, it's not the population," he had told him over glasses of lemonade at the cafe. "It's a matter of percentages. If 100%, 212 people, were all to bring their vacuum cleaners to my shop, then..." Here Signor Speranza had kissed his fingertips. "Mwah!"
Don Rocco, who was a young priest and a thoughtful one, had stirred the ice in his glass.
212, signore? He asked, his forehead rumpling. "But wouldn't that mean that every husband and every wife would have their own vacuum? And each of their children, and also?"
Signor Speranza pulled a face.
"If you want to split hairs, Father, you know what I mean. You have the same issue. It's the young people. They are the problem. We cannot even get them to stay in the town where they were born. They would rather have internet service."
Don Rocco frowned.
"Just because they have left Prometto, that does not mean they have left the church, signore.
It's possible they are going to Mass in those new places where they are.
Signor Speranza shook his head.
That's a very nice dream, Father. But we have to face the facts. Young people do not take care of vacuums, and they do not go to church. That is just the way it is. How many young people do you have going to Mass now?
Then he held up his hand.
And spare me Christmas and Easter, Father. Even the devil goes to church at Christmas and Easter.
But Don Rocco would not be drawn into talking numbers.
It's something we're doing, Signore, he said instead, glancing forlornly at the little church. We are doing something wrong.
Signor Speranza had taken a contemplative draught of lemonade.
People also like Ash Wednesday, he mused. They enjoy the drama of that, I think. Have you considered giving out ashes on other days, Father? My drama business?
Yes, clearly, the young people were to blame. Hundreds of years, and Prometto had never been in a mess like this before. Signor Speranza closed the ledger now and glared across the shop at his own personal young person, Smilzo, who was perched atop a vacuum canister in the showroom and scribbling in a notebook, the tip of his pointy nose pink with concentration. Signor Speranza and his assistant were not currently on the best of terms. A little over a month ago, in response to the customary yearly dip in business following spring cleaning season, the two of them had undertaken an informal campaign of inter-office pranks as a way of livening things up. Signor Speranza had difficulty now in remembering who had started it, and indeed it might have been accidental. One of them had mixed up the salt and the sugar or something like that. But last week, Smilzo had gone too far. It was just as Signor Speranza was calling a meeting of the local business owners to order. He had a special gavel and block of carved walnut and stored in a walnut box lined with dark blue velvet, which he kept in the top drawer of his desk and brought out for just such special occasions. All the council members had sat ranged in a semicircle in front of Signor Speranza's desk. Smilzo, who was not on the council but had been prevailed upon to take notes, had been sitting off to one side. Everyone was chatting when Signor Speranza rapped the gavel. "Order, order, please," he had called. The room had fallen silent. Signor Speranza had smiled pleasantly. "Now," he'd said, and leaned forward at his desk. At that precise moment, when all eyes and ears were riveted in Signor Speranza's direction, there had come, and most definitely emanating from Signor Speranza's chair, the loudest, most terrific fart anyone had ever heard.
"You should have seen your face, boss,"
Smilzo had said when the meeting was finally over. Then he had keeled over and clutched his stomach, engaging in the kind of helpless laughter that is so filled with mirth it produces no sound. A black box with a blinking red light was revealed, taped to the underside of Signor Speranza's chair, and a matching remote with a single button produced from Smilzo's pocket.
"Si, boss, simple,"
and Smilzo had demonstrated, pressing the button and releasing another thunderous explosion. Signor Speranza had done the only thing he could do under the circumstances, which was to plant his heavily booted foot on the seat of Smilzo's pants. He had realized later that he should have immediately confiscated the box and remote control. Now, while he wasn't exactly living in fear, it might be said he was living in a state of heightened awareness. Closing the compendium with a sigh, Signor Speranza went for a fitful walk around the shop. When he came to Smilzo, he stopped and kicked him gently in the shin.
"What's happening now?" he demanded, nodding at the notebook.
Smilzo was writing a screenplay. Signor Speranza didn't approve of screenplays, obviously, but it was sort of interesting that a person could just write something down as if it had actually happened. Smilzo looked up, his pointy face aglow.
"You'll never believe it, boss. A tornado comes and picks up the house and then it puts it down in a magical world."
Signor Speranza considered this, his mouth disappearing up into his moustache.
"Like ruby slippers?" he asked finally.
Smilzo was very still for a moment, and then a muscle under his eye twitched. and he dived back into his notebook, rubbing his eraser across the page. Signor Speranza rolled his eyes and then circled around behind his assistant so he could read over his shoulder. "Enter leading lady, Arabella, 23, tall, skinny, black hair, bubbly personality." He snorted. "That sounds just like..." The little bell over the shop door jingled. Smilzo, looking up, yelped, turned three shades of pink, and then sat on his notebook, just as Antonella Capra burst onto the scene. She was the only person Signor Speranza knew of who was skinnier than his assistant, like a walking stick of spaghetti. Today she was wearing approximately 50 bangle bracelets on each narrow wrist, and a pair of enormous pink plastic hoop earrings, one of which had got stuck in her voluminous black hair and was sticking out at an odd angle. Her thin face was bent over her phone, and she was typing very fast. "Ciao, signore," she said, aiming two air kisses in roughly the direction of Signor Speranza's cheeks, without looking up and without ceasing typing. "Do you know where Smilzo is? He's supposed to take a picture of me with a vacuum, for a joke." Signor Speranza's moustache bristled. Smilzo jumped up. "It's not really a joke, boss," he said hurriedly. "It's more like an ironic statement." Antonella looked up. "Oh, there you are." Signor Speranza sighed. He had known Antonella since she was a baby. She was 23 years old now, and for the first 22 and a half years of their acquaintance, he had, whenever he saw her, enjoyed an unobstructed view of her face. This had all changed now, since she had acquired this new gadget of hers. "What are you doing on that thing?" he asked crossly. He had used his own mobile phone exactly twice, the first time when Betta had called him to be sure it was set up properly, and the second when he had hurled it across the room to kill a spider. "Are you talking to someone?" Antonella nodded, causing one pink plastic earring to jounce up and down, and the other, which was stuck in her hair, to tremble maddeningly on the very cusp of freedom. "Who is it?" Signor Speranza persisted. Antonella let one hand go for a second and waved it around in the air. "I am talking to everyone, signore." "What does that mean?" Signor Speranza frowned. "You are talking to everyone. Are you talking to me?" Antonella sighed, and with some effort, peeled her eyes off her phone screen long enough to turn it round so Signor Speranza could see it. "Social media, signore," she said, scrolling. "I have 17 followers now, but really anyone, anywhere, can read it." Signor Speranza tried to concentrate as words and images flashed by. "Hmm," he said, nodding as if he understood. "It's the World Wide Web." Antonella giggled. "Sì, signore. Who is this one?" Signor Speranza poked his finger at the screen, trying to stop on a particular picture he kept seeing scroll past again and again. Antonella angled the phone back towards herself and tapped it. "This one?" she asked, incredulous, turning it back around. Signor Speranza blinked at the tank-topped young man who was smiling at him from inside a neon-pink heart, and whose bicep was roughly the size of Smilzo's waist. The face was familiar. "I know him," he said, pointing at the screen. "Who is it?" Antonella's mouth dropped open. "Dante Rinaldi," she said in a tone she might have used if Signor Speranza had asked her to explain what pasta was. "Dante Rinaldi!" Signor Speranza frowned, searching the young man's face. "Rinaldi, Rinaldi." He couldn't place the family. Had Giulia Scarpa married a Rinaldi? He glanced at Smilzo, who appeared to be studying the ceiling tiles. He turned back to Antonella. "He is your boyfriend?" he asked. "Boyfriend!" Antonella threw her head back and squawked. "Signore, it's Dante Rinaldi!" "He's a film star, boss," mumbled Smilzo. "Oh." Signor Speranza lost interest. "A film star." "Just look at him, signore." Antonella had apparently switched over to a page devoted exclusively to pictures of Dante Rinaldi, sporting a lurid assortment of multicoloured tank tops, and was now scrolling tenderly through them, The phone tilted outward so that Signor Speranza and Smilzo might enjoy them too. She sighed.
"Isn't he beautiful?"
Smilzo made a sound like a strangled cat and covered it with a fit of coughing.
"Look at this one,"
she said, tapping the screen, but then did a double take and stuck her lip out.
"The internet is glitching again."
She pointed her phone accusingly at Signor Speranza.
"You really need to do something about this, signore. It's a serious problem."
"Yeah, boss,"
Smilzo nodded, having recovered his composure.
"It's a very serious problem. I was watching a film on my phone last night, and right at the end, pfft."
He drew one finger across his scrawny neck.
"All gone."
Signor Speranza's eyes widened.
"A serious problem? This was their idea of a serious problem?
Do you see, Lord?"
he asked, gazing heavenwards.
"Do you see what I am dealing with here?"
He opened his mouth, and in another second he might have spilled his secret and told these two idiots what a serious problem really looked like, but he was interrupted by the jingle of the bell.
"I hope you don't mind, signore, if these two young people listen to our conversation."
Signor Speranza was ensconced at his desk at the back of the shop. Signor Rossi, a loyal constituent, sat in the upholstered chair opposite him, while Smilzo and Antonella sat alongside the desk in a pair of folding chairs, Smilzo sneaking looks at Antonella out of the corner of his eye, and Antonella scrolling through her phone and twirling her hair.
"I'm trying to show them the difference between serious and non-serious problems."
"Oh, this is a very serious problem, signore."
Signor Rossi leant forward in his chair and twisted his hat in his hands.
"It's a problem I am having with my dog."
Antonella snorted. Signor Speranza threw her a warning look and then gestured, "Please, signore, continue."
"Well, it's that she's being attacked."
Signor Speranza raised one eyebrow.
"Attacked, signore?"
Signor Rossi nodded.
"She's being attacked by my neighbor's new litter of puppies."
Signor Speranza preemptively glared at Antonella and produced a small spiral notebook and a stub of pencil.
"What kind of puppies?" he asked.
"Miniature schnauzers," said Signor Rossi.
"You know, the German ones with the ears."
Signor Speranza nodded over his notebook.
"Yes, I have seen some of those. They look like the Huns, marching.
"That's exactly right," agreed Signor Rossi.
"And these Huns, as you call them, will not leave Bambolina, that is my dog, alone. They jump on her, and they bark, they bite her ears and her tail."
Signor Rossi's eyes filled with tears.
"She is a very old dog, signore. She deserves her time in the sun."
"I completely agree, signore."
Signor Speranza made a notation in his notebook.
"And have you approached your neighbor with this complaint?"
Signor Rossi's deeply tanned cheeks flushed, turning his face a kind of dusky purple.
"Yes, I did. I spoke to both of them, and they just laughed. They said, 'How can you tell she's bothered by them? Have you checked to see if she's still alive?'"
Signor Speranza gasped. "Signore!"
Signor Rossi nodded. "I couldn't believe it myself, signore!"
The bell at the front of the shop jingled, and he glanced over his shoulder.
"But here is Bambolina now. My wife has brought her out for a walk. I will bring her in so you can meet her and see for yourself how sweet she is."
Everyone moved to the front of the shop, where Signora Rossi was negotiating the entrance. When she was finally inside, Signor Speranza saw that she was dragging a large red wagon.
"Here she is. This is Bambolina, signore," said Signor Rossi.
Signor Speranza blinked at the contents of the wagon, a little bit of the wind going out of his sails.
"So this is the famous Bambolina,"
he said, and then weakly,
"Is this how she goes for a walk?"
Signor Rossi and his wife exchanged indulgent smiles. "Bambolina has always been a bit of a princess, you see," said Signor Rossi. "I will take her out so you can say hello." Before Signor Speranza could object, Signor Rossi had removed Bambolina from the wagon and placed her heavily atop the toes of Signor Speranza's shoes. There she sat, the world's largest Pomeranian, her tongue lolling out of one side of her mouth, bright pink against a fluffy profusion of orange fur. She did not move, except for panting and blinking, and as Signor Speranza watched, mesmerized, the frequency and duration of her blinks gradually increased until finally she was sleeping. Everyone was silent for a moment, until Antonella knelt beside Bambolina.
"You are right, Signore," she said, giggling. "This is the most serious problem I have ever seen."
Then, holding her phone up, she fluffed her hair and snapped a picture. Chapter 3. Betta Finds Out. Signor Speranza closed the shop at 5:30, turning the crank that lowered his awning, and taking care to shake out the all-weather mat outside the door. When he had finished, he glanced around the little cobblestone square. Everything was just as it had been when his father was still alive. There was Bees's Emporio to his right, its tin roof baking in the late afternoon sun, and the cafe beyond it. The dentist's office was to his left. Directly across the street was Maestro's butcher's shop, and diagonally to the left, the little whitewashed building that was Santa Agata, Prometo's church. It was all anyone could ask for. Maybe there were not so many people milling about as there had been in his father's day, but there were a few. Signor Speranza watched them, and his heart sank. Unless he came up with some kind of answer to this spectacular problem they were having, in 60 days there would be no one. Everyone would be gone. 70,000 euros. The number squeezed at Signor Speranza's chest and wrung the air out of his lungs as he walked down the Via Sant'Agata towards home. How much would that be in lira? He had to stop to do the computation. Almost 136 million. "What do you make of that, Papa?" he asked out loud. Luigi Speranza, despite having departed this earth nearly 3 decades earlier, as yet occupied a small corner at the back of his son's mind. There he sat on an upturned bucket, threading red peppers on string, because that was how Signor Speranza pictured him. Today, however, Luigi Speranza had no answer, no words of advice for his son. He only hunched over his peppers and sorrowfully shook his head. Signor Speranza got all the way to the hotel before he recalled that tonight was Gianfranco's birthday party, and he had been meant to pick up balloons. As he opened the front door, his 4-year-old granddaughter Carlotta careened towards him. "Nonno!" she shouted and blew a party horn in his face. Zio Franco, who was now 93 years old to the day, sat at the Speranza kitchen table. He was not happy to be there. He was not happy to be anywhere. He was sitting beside Carlotta, who, in contrast, was having a marvellous time, and glaring at everyone, his arms crossed in billowing linen shirt sleeves, silvery patches of psoriasis showing on his elbows, and a pointy orange party hat on top of his balding head. "Go on, Zio. Open it." Signor Speranza leant over the table and nudged the little foil and ribbon-wrapped package closer to his uncle. "You'll love it, believe me." When everyone's eyes were on Zio, he dabbed his forehead with a napkin and took a long drink of water. It was exhausting, smiling like this as if everything were fine, and avoiding his wife's searching eyes. He glanced around the table. It was just them for the party. Zio, who had been picked up earlier that afternoon, Betta, little Carlotta, and Carlotta's mother, their daughter Gemma. Gemma had come to Signor Speranza and his wife late in life, an astonishing gift after they had stopped hoping. His eyes lingered on her now, as was his habit these last 5 years, ever since the news had broken, just after her 19th birthday, that they were to have a grandchild, but no son-in-law.
Was she getting smaller?
Signor Speranza narrowed his eyes and frowned, watching her pick at her cake with the tines of her fork.
"Let me help you, Zio,"
said Carlotta, who was dazzled by the shiny paper. Hopping down from her chair, she wrested the box from Zio Franco's not altogether cooperative hands and tore it open.
"Lego!" she crowed.
Zio Franco slouched in his chair and grunted.
"What the hell am I supposed to do with that?"
Signor Speranza managed a manic grin and shoveled an enormous forkful of cake into his mouth.
"You're a builder, Zio. I thought you would like to build something."
He continued his grinning and shoveling until his black moustache was dotted with white frosting and he looked insane.
"I think it's offensive," said Gemma,
putting her fork down and clamping her arms over her chest.
"Who gives a 93-year-old man a kid's toy for a birthday present? It's rude."
Signor Speranza's mouth dropped open. This cutting little statement constituted almost a full-blown speech for his daughter, who didn't ordinarily go out of her way to speak to him at all. Betta motioned him to keep quiet from the other end of the table.
"I don't think that's how Papa meant it, Gemma," she said, her voice soothing. "It's just a little joke. Something for Zio to play with Carlotta. Isn't that right, Nino?"
Now Signor Speranza crossed his arms and scowled. Carlotta clutched the box to her chest, almost bursting with excitement.
"Can I open it, Zio?"
Zio Franco muttered that she could keep it for all he cared, and within seconds she had the box open and had popped one of the plastic bags, sending Lego pieces skittering everywhere, including one that landed in the remains of Signor Speranza's cake. He picked it out and brightly changed the subject.
"I've been wanting to talk to you about your house, Zio."
Zio Franco's already petulant face hardened into a stiff mask, and Betta made a tusking sound, but Signor Speranza did not back down. If he was going to have to convince this uncle of his, who was stubborn as a mule, to leave Prometto peacefully in 60 days' time, he needed to get cracking on it now.
"Zio, please, understand. I know you're attached to your house, but I think it's time. It's not good for you to be there all alone."
Zio Franco shook his head.
"I am not moving."
Signor Speranza persisted.
"Did you see the advertisement I left for you last week? That place looks very nice. Units starting at 4,000 euros.
Zio Franco snorted.
"That was a mausoleum."
Signor Speranza's eyebrows lifted.
"What are you talking about? It's a condominium complex."
Betta, at her end of the table, stifled a whoop of laughter.
"No, Nino," she said when she got hold of herself. "Zio is right. I looked at the ad myself. The Garden of Everlasting Roses is a mausoleum."
Signor Speranza was baffled.
"It said they have air conditioning," he marveled, and then mystified. "Who is the air conditioning for?"
Zio Franco ignored all this and pounded his fist.
"It would take 3 armies of men to remove me from my home."
Signor Speranza rolled his eyes to the ceiling.
"Or one oversized toddler with a clipboard." "Papa," said Gemma, "I think that Zio should be able to make up his own."
Signor Speranza turned to her, beseeching, "Cara mia, please." Gemma's quiet eyes flashed.
"All right," she said, her lip trembling. "Who am I to have an opinion?"
She stood up, her chair knocking over behind her.
"Maybe for my birthday you can get me a Barbie doll."
She ran out of the kitchen and into her bedroom, slamming the door behind her. Carlotta looked up from her Lego bricks and started to cry. Betta folded her hands on the table and sighed.
"Oh, Nino." "What?"
Signor Speranza shouted, throwing his hands in the air.
"What did I say?"
"All right, that's it." With Zio gone and Gemma and Carlotta in bed, Betta closed the bedroom door behind her and put her hands on her hips.
"You tell me what's happening right now. You are like a crazy person tonight. What is bothering you?"
Signor Speranza sank onto the bed, and Betta sat beside him.
The story came out in fits and starts. Oh, Nino. Betta covered her mouth with her hand. They sat there for a while in silence, and then the cogs of her brisk and practical mind began to turn.
Well, there has to be an answer.
You have to talk to Don Rocco, she said. He'll take up a collection.
Signor Speranza sighed. To collect from whom? Betta, we are in this mess because no one has any money. You know how many people have not paid their taxes?
He knew. He had their names marked in the town ledger, with their excuses alongside on sticky notes. It was a mess. It was all a mess. Betta chewed her lip.
What about Signor Maestro? He has to have money. Have you seen that ridiculous house?
Signor Speranza grimaced. He had not had cause to enter Signor Maestro's domicile, thank God, but he saw him every day outside the butcher's shop, a large gold and diamond ring sparkling on his pinky finger. Imagine the blood and guts that must be stuck in the prongs of that ring. He shuddered.
Signor Maestro is a barbarian, he said. He will not be interested in helping anyone but himself.
He shook his head and got into bed.
Try not to worry. We will have a place to live. Tomorrow I'll call Alberto.
Betta, who had her own views on the said Alberto, pulled a face and got into bed also. As she pulled up the covers, her eyes wandered to the wall that separated their room from Gemma and Carlotta's.
Do you think they'll want to move with us? She whispered.
Signor Speranza was startled.
Of course they will move with us. Where else would they go?
But even as he spoke, he felt uneasy. The last time Betta had asked him a question like that, in that worried voice, had been 5 years ago.
Nino, you don't think Gemma is getting too serious with this Ricci boy, do you?
And he had been sure then, also.
I've seen her texting him, you know, said Betta quietly, looking at her hands. He's in Rome, I think. We cannot afford Rome, Nino.
Signor Speranza sat up.
So what? He blustered.
He could feel his blood pressure rising and a pounding in his temples. It was the feeling he always got when he was boxing an invisible enemy.
So what? No one is keeping her here. If she wanted to go, she would go. She likes it here.
Shh, said Betta, her eyes flicking again to the wall.
Yes, Nino, she likes it here. She likes the school for Carlotta. She doesn't want to take her away from her friends, but...
She shrugged.
What if there is no school? What if the friends are gone? What then?
Signor Speranza had no answer for this.
I worry about her, Nino, Betta sighed. It's as if she has given up. No friends, no interests. She's angry or depressed all the time. I worry. Maybe...
She hesitated.
Maybe it's not the worst thing that could happen, if she and Carlotta were to move away, start their own life.
Signor Speranza grunted and turned out the light. In the dark, he saw himself and Carlotta 4 years ago. He was walking the floor with her as she cried in the middle of the night, while her mother cried in the room next door.
Gallinella, zoppa, zoppa, quante pene tieni in coppa.
He sang softly, the old song about the little lame hen and how many feathers she had on her back. When he stopped singing, Gemma had called out in her thin, stretched voice.
Sing it again, papa,
she said, and he had sung it over and over until both his little girls were sleeping. Now, tonight, he bunched his pillow under his head and pretended to sleep, until he heard the sound of Betta gently snoring. Then he climbed out of bed and knelt at the side, as he had when he was a child. He grunted a little as his knees struck the hard floor, and that electric jolt of old age shot through his joints. He made the sign of the cross and scrunched his eyes shut. In his mind, he paged through the compendium, trying to decide to whom he should appeal for help. In the end, given the dire circumstances, he went directly to the manager.
"Please, Lord," he said, whispering aloud, "I do not know what to do.
If you have the answer, please show it to me.
He waited a few minutes, in case God wanted to make a really grand gesture and tell him what he should do on the spot, but when nothing happened, he climbed back into bed and stayed awake, deep into the night, arguing with Betta in his mind. Because she was wrong. Gemma and Carlotta moving away was the worst thing that could possibly happen. Chapter 4. The Mysterious Whereabouts of George Clooney. At dawn, Signor Speranza was dreaming of when Gemma was young.
Papa.
He was in the hotel's living room, but it was the living room of 20 years ago. At the windows there were the pink watered silk curtains with puffed flounces, which Betta had found at a flea market. And he was sitting on the old scratchy couch with the crewel work flowers on the cushions. He peered over the top of his newspaper.
Papa, you said you would come to my tea party.
There was little Gemma, as real as anything. She was standing with her arms crossed, the way her own daughter did now. Then Signor Speranza found that he was no longer his younger self, sitting there on the couch. Rather, he seemed to have floated up and was looking down on the scene from above. He had been here before, he realized, in this actual place. He had participated in this actual conversation. He wasn't so much dreaming as remembering. He saw his younger self lower the newspaper and raise one eyebrow. He watched his old moustache, the very peak of its luxurious lushness, twitch from side to side.
"Will there be biscuits?"
he heard himself ask in a mock-serious tone. They moved to the table, and Gemma told him about school.
"I don't like it,"
she said, staring fiercely at the little china teapot.
"Everyone is mean there. Why can't I just stay home?"
The young Signor Speranza had not got the moment right. He had miscalculated, he had teased. And the older Signor Speranza, who was watching from the ceiling, did not remember in time and missed his chance to do it over again a different way. He watched his younger self rumple his daughter's hair.
"You can't stay home forever, Cucuzza," he said. "Pretty soon, when you are big, your mamma and I will kick you out."
Little Gemma had flung her head back and gasped, just as if her father had slapped her across the face.
"I am never going to leave," she cried. "Never, never, never."
And then she had thrown the teapot, and it had smashed on the floor. Signor Speranza woke with a start. It was morning. The events of long ago faded, and the events of yesterday trickled back to him, and he fell back on his pillow and sighed. Just outside the door, he heard the scuffling sound of his daughter's slippers.
"Gemma," he called.
He heard her pause, and then walk on. She didn't answer. With no word yet from God, Signor Speranza took his coffee in bed and activated the municipal phone chain, alerting residents to a town meeting on a vague but critical topic, to be held 2 days hence at 8 o'clock Monday evening in the church. He would have preferred it to be tomorrow, but there wasn't any sense in wrecking everyone's Sunday. Then he rang his old school friend, Alberto Martini, who now lived 30 kilometres north in Oliveto, about renting a 3-bedroom apartment.
"He says we have to act fast or we will miss our chance," Signor Speranza told Betta after hanging up the phone.
"He says places are going like hot cakes." Betta, whose usual equanimity was more or less restored this morning, was folding towels. She shook one out and raised her eyebrows.
"In Oliveto? Tch!"
Swiftly she gathered the towel into a neat square.
"That man is a con artist. I don't know why you are friends with him."
"He might be a useful friend to have," Signor Speranza said, glancing at the notepad on the nightstand, which was covered in penciled computations.
"We are not dealing with a lot of capital here."
Betta clapped her stack of towels between two hands and started for the linen closet.
"If the apartment is in Alberto and Maria's house, I would rather live on the side of the road."
30 minutes later, Signor Speranza parked in front of the Martini home. They lived on the outskirts of town, in one of the newer houses with a clay tile roof. Alberto was waiting on the portico, smoking a cigar,
the smoke mingling in the hazy July heat, and when he saw Signor Speranza pull up, he began waving his arms.
"Hallo, Speranza!" he hollered. "How are you doing, you magnificent son of a bitch?"
Signor Speranza climbed out of his car, uttering a quick prayer of thanksgiving that Betta hadn't insisted on coming with him. He could almost hear her.
"That's it, we're done."
"Where did you steal that thing?" Signor Speranza called, pointing at the garage. He could just make out the bumper of a red Alfa Romeo. Alberto grinned, twirling his cigar. "What can I say? I got lucky."
With Alberto, there was no going to see the apartment and then going home. He had to make a production of it.
"I told Betta I would not be too long," said Signor Speranza, glancing at his watch. They were in the Alfa Romeo now, with the top down, riding around town. "She'll be fine," said Alberto, cranking up the radio. He was a spry 63, and driving, he gave the impression of a little kid playing a car racing game at an arcade, bouncing on the seat, his feet scarcely reaching the pedals.
"Besides, this is part of the tour. You are not only renting an apartment, you are renting all of this."
He made a flourish with his hand to encompass the surrounding area, with its dusty trees and its haphazard traffic signs, and the car veered sharply, nearly careening into a pair of indignant chickens on the side of the road. Signor Speranza sighed. As he looked around, the 11 o'clock sun broiling the top of his head, and the wind whipping his moustache into a froth, he could not help but notice that things were different here from the last time he had visited. When was that? He frowned. 6 months ago, a year? However long it had been, something had happened. The Oliveto he remembered was even sleepier than Prometto, if that were possible. But today the Alfa Romeo wound through streets filled with life. There was a velvet rope outside the pokey little cafe with a line of people behind it waiting to get in. The car turned onto the main boulevard, and Signor Speranza did a double take. Was that a McDonald's? Betta would never believe it. Signor Speranza turned to his friend and shouted over the radio in the roar of the engine.
"What's all this? What has happened here?"
Alberto grinned.
"Isn't it great?" he shouted back. "It's a great story. You know George Clooney, film star, American."
Signor Speranza considered. Film stars were not his speciality. He turned the radio down.
"What film?" "You know," Alberto rolled his eyes, "the ocean film. They rip off a big casino."
Signor Speranza racked his brain.
"Oh, right," he said finally. "Il Biondo."
Alberto shook his head.
"No, no, that's Brad Pitt. The other one, black hair, the one with the aunt. You know, Mambo Italiano."
He did a little dance in his seat.
"Okay."
Signor Speranza was getting impatient. He could just see Betta making her hand into a puppet, talking, talking. "Chiacchierone," she would say, exasperated.
"So,"
said Alberto, looking directly at Signor Speranza, not at the road at all, his disconcerting blue eyes shining.
"About 6 months ago, a big magazine runs a story. George Clooney thinks he will buy a house in Oliveto." "No kidding,"
Signor Speranza said aloud.
"Why would he want to do that?" he said in his head.
Alberto was looking at the road again, but he took one hand off the wheel to snap his fingers.
"Just like that, everything changes. People come from all over. If this place is good enough for George Clooney, they say, then it is good enough for me."
"No kidding,"
Signor Speranza murmured again. Alberto whipped the Alfa Romeo into a parking space on a cramped, ill-lit street. "We're here," he announced, snapping off his seatbelt. Signor Speranza looked around. There wouldn't be anywhere for Carlotta to ride her bike on a street like this. He didn't like the look of one of the houses, either, with an old washing machine rusting on the lawn and a dented sign tacked to the fence, "Beware of Dog." He got out of the car and stepped gingerly over the broken curb.
"And," he asked, curious, "where is George Clooney?"
Alberto pressed his key fob, making the red car beep, and grinned so widely that Signor Speranza could see one of his silver crowns.
"I don't know," he said brightly.
If I see Brad Pitt, maybe I'll ask him.
Needs a spruce up, said Alberto, picking his way through the layer of rubbish that carpeted the living room floor of the limited-time-only get-it-while-it's-hot three-bedroom apartment.
You said it had a back garden,
said Signor Speranza, staring out of the back window. Alberto joined him.
It does, he said, pointing. See, the property goes to the tree line.
Signor Speranza suppressed the urge to wring his friend's scrawny neck.
It's a ravine.
Hmm, said Alberto, looking down. You did not want a ravine? Signor Speranza gazed at the ceiling, noticing an alarming brown patch of water damage. Alberto's eyes followed his.
Look, Speranza, I know it's not perfect, he said in that smooth-talking tone Betta hated. But you just have to think of it as a starter home.
Signor Speranza laughed bitterly.
I am 62 years old. I am past the point of starter homes.
Listen. Alberto was getting bored. He kept fidgeting and glancing towards the door.
I can give it to you for 700 a month.
Signor Speranza's mouth dropped open.
700 a month? I thought you said you could give me a deal.
Alberto threw his hands in the air.
700 is a deal. Wake up, Speranza. How much do you think things cost? Where are you going to go? Rome? For 700 a month, they might let you piss in a bucket.
Signor Speranza closed his eyes and rubbed the sides of his head. It had not been helpful, Alberto mentioning Rome like that. With his eyes closed, he noticed the smells, the mildew and the wood rot and the mouse droppings. Finally, he opened his eyes and held out his hand.
Grazie, Alberto, he said. Mille grazie. I will talk to my wife.
Chapter 5. Signor Speranza consults his conscience. When Signor Speranza arrived back in Prometto, he sat in the car for an hour, trying and failing to picture Gemma in that apartment of Alberto's. Then he turned off the ignition and walked into town. He had not smoked a cigarette in 25 years, but he was smoking one now. He stood outside Maestro's butcher's shop, glaring up at the battered, stuffed boar mounted over the awning and sucking his cigarette down to the filter. He had spent a fair amount of time contemplating this boar over the years. It was missing one tusk and stared beadily over the horizon, and sometimes, when Signor Maestro came outside and stood on the step in his white apron, gazing stupidly in the same direction, they looked like brothers.
"Maestro is not my friend,"
Signor Speranza muttered aloud. Then he pointed his cigarette stub at the boar.
"He was not your friend either."
The boar did not answer. Signor Speranza looked up at the sky.
"This, lord?" he asked, raising one eyebrow. "This is what you want me to do?"
There was no answer from that quarter either.
Signor Speranza sighed. There wasn't any other way forward that he could see. No one else in Prometto had any money.
He tossed his cigarette on the ground.
"Signore," he called heartily as he entered the shop, throwing his hands in the air. "So good to see you. You look as if you could wrestle a bear. Business is good."
Signor Maestro, who was standing behind the counter like a pillar of wood, made a guttural sound in his throat.
"What do you want, Speranza?"
Signor Speranza meandered around, trying to keep it casual and perusing the merchandise. He wondered if Signor Maestro went home smelling like salami and copper.
"Well, this is good, very good," he said, nodding at the rack of cured salamis. "You have a wonderful selection. I tell everyone that. You must be making a lot of good money here."
When Signor Maestro remained silent, Signor Speranza decided he had better put his money where his mouth was. He bent in front of the largest glass case and pointed at a pair of pork chops.
"I'll take these," he said. "Betta will be pleased."
Signor Maestro took down an order slip and licked the point of his pencil.
"Where do you want me to send it?" he asked.
Signor Speranza balked.
"I don't need you to send it anywhere. I'm standing right here,"
Signor Maestro swung his pencil out, pointing at a laminated sign. All meets this case, mail order only.
New policy, he grunted. I had to make some changes. How else am I to make money in this town? The world is out there, Speranza.
He slugged one of his giant paws in the same direction the boar outside was looking. Signor Speranza blinked first at the sign and then at Signor Maestro.
How long does that take? He asked, incredulous.
Signor Maestro shrugged his fat shoulders.
3 to 5 business days, depending on where you're located.
Signor Speranza felt his blood pressure shoot up 10 points, and he forgot why he was there.
I'm located directly in front of you.
He regretted this outburst immediately, of course. There was silence for a moment, and then from the back room the sound of chairs scraping against the floor. That would be Maestro's sons, no doubt, coming to defend their father's honour and his right to sell meat exclusively via mail order. Could all 15 of the sons fit back there? Signor Speranza wondered dizzily, trying to peer over Maestro's shoulder. Was it still possible to make a run for it?
Signor Maestro, meanwhile, had crossed his arms over his gore-smeared apron. "Do we have a problem here, Speranza?" he growled.
Signor Speranza held up his hands.
"I was just joking. Send them to me. I don't care how. Post office, carrier pigeon. I would love to eat them for dinner next week."
Signor Maestro counted Signor Speranza's bills into his stuffed cash register. Signor Speranza stared balefully at the thick stacks of money, remembering why he had come here in the first place.
"Signore," he said in as pleasant a voice as he could muster, "you are a businessman. Have you ever considered investing in Prometto? Putting money back into the community?"
Signor Maestro snorted and slammed the cash drawer shut, tearing off the receipt.
"Speranza," he grunted, "don't be an idiot."
The next day was Sunday. Signor Speranza slept late and woke with a headache.
"Where is your mother?"
he grumbled to Gemma when he padded into the kitchen. Gemma was at the table, sitting in front of an untouched glass of orange juice and hunched like Antonella over her phone. She didn't look up.
"She took Carlotta to church."
Signor Speranza grunted and dragged out a chair.
"What about you?" he asked peevishly. "You don't have to go to church."
Gemma glanced over the top of her phone and stuck out her tongue.
"And what about you, Papa? You have a dispensation?"
Signor Speranza frowned, drawing his mouth up and into his moustache and emitting an indistinct burbling noise which indicated he was not currently available for theological debate.
"Who are you talking to?" he asked instead.
There was a pause. Then,
"Nobody,"
said Gemma, shrugging, her voice half an octave higher than usual. Signor Speranza felt the old familiar well of panic. Better if his daughter were like Antonella, trying to talk to everyone. Everyone was better than what he suspected was this particular nobody. He cleared his throat and made his own voice light and casual.
"Do you ever talk to Luca Ricci anymore?"
he asked, his eyes wide and innocent.
"You know, I saw his cousin."
It was a mistake.
"Papa!"
said Gemma, her eyes flashing, just like the little girl who had thrown the teapot. She clutched her phone to her chest and flung back her chair.
"I'm going out," she muttered, and stalked out of the kitchen.
Signor Speranza listened as the front door slammed. He gazed at the ceiling and sighed.
Where had he gone wrong? Where had it all gone wrong?
He looked at the cracks in the ceiling, and his mind wandered.
"Am I on that sign, nonno?"
He could hear Carlotta asking dimly, as if from somewhere very far away.
"Am I one of the numbers?"
It was 5 months ago, and he and Carlotta were walking home in a wet February wind from the beach. They had just come upon Prometto's weather-beaten sign, mounted crookedly on a stake at the side of the road, and Carlotta was staring up at it, awestruck. "Prometto, population 212.
Signor Speranza had looked down at his granddaughter, so small and so eager, and utterly disbelieving that she could merit such an honour, and his throat had felt strangely constricted.
"Of course, tesoro," he had choked. "Of course you are on that sign. What do you think?"
She had clapped her little hands with the joy of it.
He had not lied to her, Signor Speranza told himself sternly as they continued their walk. She was one of the numbers. She was. He had just not seen any need to tell her the whole story. Why would a little girl need to know that the sign hadn't changed when she was born? The baby had come, and, before even bothering to see her, the father had left. It had been a one-for-one switch.
At 6 a.m. Monday, the day that Signor Speranza was meant to stand up in front of his friends and neighbours and weep and tell them they were all going to lose their houses, he woke with a strangled cry. The sound woke Betta, and she sat bolt upright.
"What is it, Nino? What happened?"
Signor Speranza, who was tangled in the sheets, struggled to sit up.
"I was robbing a casino,"
he gasped, his heart still pounding. He squinted, trying to remember the details. Yes, he had been rappelling down the side of a shiny building, a pack of money on his back, but when he'd looked up, he'd seen the junior plumbing inspector looming at the top, his clip-on tie whipping in the wind, sawing through his rope with a knife.
"Alberto was there too," he said, frowning at the memory. "I think he was singing Mambo Italiano."
Betta groaned and dropped back on her pillows.
"A nightmare," she said. "Any dream with Alberto is a nightmare. Now go back to sleep."
She turned on her side and pulled the blanket up to her chin. But Signor Speranza was fully awake now.
"Did I tell you George Clooney, the actor, was supposed to buy a house in Oliveto?" he asked. "Alberto told me."
He related the whole story about the magazine article.
Betta snorted. "George Clooney? In Oliveto?"
Signor Speranza nodded.
"That's what the magazine said." "And who told the magazine, huh?"
Betta closed her eyes to go back to sleep.
"Three guesses, and they are all Alberto."
Betta's words knocked around in Signor Speranza's head as he got up and washed his face, and as he walked to work 2.5 hours early. They kept bobbing back to the surface as he sat at his desk and paged through the compendium in search of a last-minute rescue team, until all the saints' names blurred and ran together.
"Three guesses, and they are all Alberto."
"Well, and so what if it were true?" Signor Speranza thought with a surge of defiance. "What if Alberto had started that rumour himself? Maybe it was wrong, technically speaking, to lie, but in this case, wasn't it also sort of brilliant? People nowadays didn't know what they wanted, or they thought they wanted one thing until a celebrity on TV told them they wanted something else. Everything had to be bigger, better, new and improved. A fading place like Oliveto or Prometo didn't stand a chance without a little edge. And what harm did it do? George Clooney wasn't sweating it. It was a victimless crime. If a few vapid people believing that some film star wanted to come to Prometo could jumpstart the economy and save people's houses, then what was it to anyone, really?
What is it to God?
Signor Speranza thought with a twinge of conscience. He glanced up then through the front window and spotted Don Rocco across the square, sweeping the little pathway in front of the church. Signor Speranza hastened across the shop and opened the front door, the bell jingling.
"Good morning, Father," he called, waving. "How about breakfast? My treat."
15 minutes later, Signor Speranza and Don Rocco sat at their usual table at the café, the one next to the dusty olive tree that the café's proprietress, Signora Catuzza, watered with leftover cooking liquids, and which therefore always smelled vaguely of chicken soup. Signor Speranza was eyeing the unwitting young priest who was shoveling frittata into his mouth without a care in the world, as one would an opponent. How, he wondered, could he put this so as to get the answer he was looking for?
"Let me ask you something, Father," he began lightly, and then drained his cup of espresso in a single gulp.
Pretend that I say something to you, hypothetically speaking, only you take me at my word. Would that mean that I have lied to you? This, Signor Speranza thought, was his best shot at avoiding mortal sin. If he were just to let slip, casually, that it would really be something if some famous person, Brad Pitt, for example, were thinking of buying a house in Prometo, then he wouldn't actually be lying, would he? Linguistically, grammatically, he wouldn't have done anything wrong. Don Rocco wiped his mouth with his napkin and considered.
That does not sound like a lie to me, signore. That sounds like a misunderstanding.
Ha! Signor Speranza clapped his hands and pointed at the priest. A misunderstanding. Yes, that's perfect. Thank you, father.
Don Rocco frowned. But if you're hoping I'll misunderstand, then that changes matters, signore. That's different territory altogether.
Signor Speranza's momentary exuberance fizzled out and his moustache drooped.
Of course, father, of course, he mumbled.
Moodily he pushed his food around his plate. It was all over then. There was no answer to his problem. It would take a miracle to save them now. With his fork he flipped over his piece of toast, and happening to glance at it, he gasped.
Father, what does this look like to you?
He plucked the toast off the plate and showed it to the priest. Don Rocco squinted. Semolina?
It's baby Jesus, father, Signor Speranza pointed. See the halo here and the manger.
He tilted the toast so the priest could see it better.
I think there is even a cow, or maybe a donkey. Let me see that, signore.
Signor Speranza handed the toast over and waited on the edge of his seat.
Could be something big, father, he said, excited. People would come from all over to see something like that.
Don Rocco examined the toast, turning it over and holding it up to the sun, and then, when he was finished, he shrugged.
Sorry, signore, I don't see it, he said, and took a big bite.